Welcome to Agents of Tech, the podcast where we talk to the leading minds in big data, artificial intelligence, and other transformative technologies that will hopefully improve our lives. I'm so pleased to be joined by my co-host, Audrey Godfrey.
Stephen, it's so great to be here, getting to do this podcast together, face to face. Coming up a little bit later on, we will be talking to Dr. Alan Aspuru-Guzik about how AI can accelerate scientific research and create labs for the future.
But first, the public health system was under the lens at the American Public Health Association annual meeting in Atlanta, Georgia. AJ Gupta, CEO of HSR Health, and Esther Geraghty, Chief Medical Officer Esri, met with our colleague Deirdre Johnson to discuss how tech can be used to fight new and ongoing health threats.
All this week, we've been discussing the pressure the public health system is under to modernize and be responsive to new and ongoing public health threats. Joining us now in studio is Ajay Gupta and Esti Geraghty to discuss how we make that happen. Well, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Deidre. We're happy to be here.
Thanks for having us.
That's wonderful. Talk to me first off about some of these public health challenges that we're facing.
Yeah.
This is where to start.
I know. Right? Well, we could probably go on and on, but I think one of the things that's happening, I think we're seeing there are emerging threats that are coming all the time. So public health needs to be more agile in order to constantly respond to new challenges. And each new challenge requires a plethora of data resources. And those data resources may come from highly disparate sources. So integrating the data in a way that makes it easier for public health to respond and use the data and be efficient is another challenge. I think one of the things that we learned from COVID, I think we knew this before, but COVID really highlighted that when we're in the middle of a response, we have to be really aware of potential inequities in how we allocate our resources. That became blatantly obvious during the pandemic. So it's a huge challenge to really consider all of the factors and be fair in the way that we do those things. And the last thing that I'll mention, I don't know what you think, but solutions nowadays really need to be scalable because the magnitude of the emergencies we're seeing is growing. And you could look at, of course, COVID and the Johns Hopkins dashboard. I know that that dashboard at the height of the pandemic was receiving over 450 billion hits per day. That's more scale than most public health departments feel they can manage. So they need technologies and solutions that are able to scale with today's threats.
Yeah, Esther, you're 100% right that the factors that influence public health risks are only growing, whether it's climate change or heat or deforestation or simply our growing and aging population. You're also right that when we deploy some of these resources, we don't necessarily deploy them in a way that benefits all equally. Mm-hmm. But I think the greatest challenge, and you sort of hinted at it, the greatest challenge is really creating an economic model that makes the solutions viable. Mm-hmm. And I say that because while the challenges are great, we actually do have solutions that can address them individually and around the world, right? From a preventive, a surveillance, a treatment basis. We have the solutions. If not together, at least we have them in part. But what we don't have is that mechanism to make it viable to deploy those solutions, to design those solutions, and actually make sure they're provided equally to all who may need them. And that requires an economic model that incentivizes the effort it takes to put those in place, and that provides someone a positive return on that effort. If we create that, then I think these problems will abate to some extent. And if we don't, then we will always seem to be running from health emergency to health emergency.
And so talk to me also now about disruptive technologies and what that has to do with, you know, public health system.
Well, there really are a lot of disruptive technologies. I'd say that we have a lot and we don't have enough because there are so many health challenges. For instance, using biotech and machine learning mechanisms to increase the speed of new drug discovery holds a lot of promise, right? Hopefully we can get new drugs to treat illnesses at less cost. There are also other ways to be innovative, maybe use a drone to deliver medications to places that aren't served by a local pharmacy. But I think one of the things, and we were even trying to work on this ourselves, is having what we see as a ChatGPT style generative AI system as a front end to our public health analytics resources. Right now, to do public health analytics, you really kind of need either coding or true data science, data analytics skills, right? And that's a barrier because not everybody has that. Certainly not every public health association or organization may have that. But if we can create a prompt style conversational interface to that data, then we can unleash all of the data insights to everyone. So instead of having to do advanced analysis to find out where heat health is going to be impacted, imagine if you could just ask a question: where in Paris are going to be the hardest hit areas from a heat wave next year? That would be a game changer. And I think that's the kind of solution we need in public health.
But I think there's still a reason for all of those data scientists out there to keep training, because they'll have to help train the models, right?
Absolutely.
So they're going to need to be able to work together, is what you're saying, the AI, the ChatGPT, something like that, and then also the data scientists.
Yeah. I think there's always a role for the human touch. Certainly we have to monitor, AI is pretty new to us, at least the generative AI, and we need to be able to monitor that and correct it and train it properly, look for the unintended consequences, or even anticipate them, better yet, be proactive. But there are also some things, perhaps, we'll see, that generative AI can't do. And I still like the human touch when it comes to health concerns. People are worried often, or they have complex issues that aren't as easily solved. So I think we continue to have room for both, but I love your vision. I think it's really amazing.
You're right. The technology is not a replacement. It's a tool that we use. So it's great here being at APHA, where there's 13,000 public health experts. Absolutely. We all have to learn how to use technology in a way that makes our jobs, our capacities better. But it doesn't mean that we want next year's conference to have only 2,000. We want to grow the field also.
Yeah.
All right. And so talk to me about cybersecurity and the role of cybersecurity really with, you know, the public health system and, you know, how it really impacts everything.
Yeah, I see cybersecurity as a thing that is never finished, right? Mm-hmm. We're never at a point where, yeah, I've got security handled. It just doesn't work that way. It's always modulating, it's always changing, it's always adapting to the mechanisms that we're doing to try to keep data safe. I think one thing that I would recommend to everybody, whether they are building a technical solution or using a technical solution, is to consider all of the compliance measures like HITRUST as a starting point for discussion on security, not the end point. Don't just be happy that you are HITRUST compliant or whatever compliance mechanism is in your industry, in your space, but say, now that we're compliant, what should we be doing, right? You certainly should leverage all of your technology partners, whether it's cloud hosting or a service provider, for what they can do. And I'd say also, as a population health company as we are, we do have a little bit of an advantage because we're using broad sets of aggregated data across the population and not individual data on a person. So that does change a little bit of the posture of our security risk, but it is, again, something that you have to think through on an ongoing basis.
And Essie, anything you want to add to that about cybersecurity or anything?
Well, I do agree that, and I think what you were saying is sort of security by design, right? It starts up front rather than an afterthought, oh, we have to fix this to be compliant with measures. So, but it's a broad topic. I mean, cybersecurity is one thing, and in public health, we often also think about privacy, and that is similar but separate. And so so I think about the topic broadly. And one of the things that I really think is important is we think about technology and the issues with that, with privacy, but there's people in process as well. And that's often where you find the breaches or the problems that happen with health data. So you need to address all of the different aspects and make sure people are well trained, that the governance process is well thought out, and of course that the technology is secure.
Okay, and what is the future, you know, of public health? You know, what can people look forward to? What are we seeing, whether it's, you know, modernization, something with cybersecurity, or just moving forward, what can people look forward to?
Now, if we had our crystal ball. Yeah, I think we are certainly at an inflection point, and maybe people always think that, but we are at an inflection point now where we do see the advent of great new technologies coming to public health, coming to the world in general, right? Whether it's biotech, whether it's genetic, whether it is artificial intelligence like generative AI that is going to change how we can do that. And we also, on the other side of the ledger, we see a vast growth in the disease factors, right? We mentioned some of them earlier, right? We know deforestation and increases the risk of zoonotic spillover, like COVID. Like, we also see antimicrobial resistance happening on a scale that wouldn't have anticipated even 10 years ago. So we do see both factors changing. And so where is the future? Well, I think it's going to come down to whether we as a society, as whether all of us, have the will to put in place these measures. You know, it's going to take collaboration, right? As a pandemic shows, diseases do not know borders. They do not know local customs and politics, right? They will spread from anyone to anyone and everyone everywhere. And so there's going to have to be some degree of collaboration. No country can fight a global pandemic by themselves, right? Because supply chains are multinational, the economy is global, people will be coming and going. So that is going to force us to make a choice. Are we going to collaborate? Are we going to create economic models that enable the deployment of these large solutions? Or are we not? And then are we going to be susceptible to small diseases becoming big problems?
And you spoke about really quickly about collaboration. Does that go with healthcare equity and just working together? You talked about, you know, everything being like a global issue.
Yes. So it does go with healthcare equity, right? Healthcare equity or health equity in general came about because some solutions were available to portions of the population and not to everyone. Some solutions sometimes are available to people who don't need it and not to those who do. So, you know, as a personal example, my wife and I still have insurance and we have maternal care. We're not having any children, right, at our age, right? Yeah. And there's far too many young women who don't have maternal care, right? That is an embarrassment, really, in very real terms. So we do have to figure out how we can collaborate, how we can get the care that's needed to those who need it.
And Essie, did you want to talk about the future of public health or even healthcare equity or health equity in general?
I want to talk about all of it. I think my vision of the future of public health is certainly optimistic because I believe that everybody in public health has got this sense of idealism and altruism to achieve the ultimate goal, which I think is that equity goal to begin with, which is to make sure that everybody has their best opportunity to achieve their optimal health. But beyond that, I think that public health can focus on, in the ideal world, prevention over treatment and band-aids to solutions. And I think we want them to be proactive instead of reactive. I mean, that's where technology becomes critical because that gives not only the push, but the enablement in terms of, we talked about scale and capacity. You know, public health is getting some more dollars after COVID, but never enough dollars. So how do you do more with less? How do you achieve the vision of equity, of being preventive and proactive when you have the same amount of resources and magnifying problems? You need the support of technologies that are vetted and can do a good job for you and streamline processes. So I think while I don't actually believe we'll ever achieve the vision, because as you've said, I think we both said, the world is evolving and the challenges will keep changing. I think we will continue to get closer to achieving that vision.
Hey, I want to thank you all so much for being here and for talking to us about, you know, public health. Thanks so much.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you, Deidre. Thank you for having us.
So lots to unpack there in that discussion. A ChatGPT for public health. The need for international collaboration to fight global pandemics, and how are we going to pay for all these massive tech advancements?
Lots of questions there. Well, this acceleration in machine learning and tech was also up for discussion at the recent Materials Research Society meeting in Boston, Massachusetts. Our colleague, Katie Brace, caught up with Dr. Alan Aspuru-Guzik, a professor of chemistry and computer science at the University of Toronto. He conducts research in quantum information, machine learning, and chemistry, and he's interested in creating labs of the future to accelerate scientific discovery. He also discusses the very pressing question of whether AI can make a good cup of tea.
That also is the big question, for, as any Englishman will tell you.
Right.
Now joining us is Alan Aspuru-Guzik. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
So your research is a unique intersection of chemistry, machine learning, and quantum computing. How do these fields interact in what you do, in your work?
All of those fields have something in common. They are technology drivers that are transforming society in the 21st century. Quantum computing is a huge movement. Several companies and several governments are investing a lot in those technologies. And my group was one of the pioneers that started thinking about how to simulate molecules and materials with it. Same with AI and automation. Very early on, about 10 years ago, we started thinking about how to use AI for chemistry, and about 5 years ago, how to use robotics for chemistry. Just found out there's 11 symposia on automation and material science just in the MRS. So I'm lucky to kind of start in the fields a little bit earlier than somebody else. And that's why those two disparate things are research done in my lab.
So you touched on this a little bit, but how do you see AI elevating what we can accomplish in science at large?
It's not only AI, but the combination of AI and automation. AI is kind of like the brain, but we are nothing without our hands. right? If you ask an AI, and this is something I took from Susan Gilderth from Sanctuary, she says, ask an AI to make you a cup of tea. Let's see how well it does, right? It takes a while to actually do all the planning and all the execution for actually making you a good cup of tea. All of that automation is crucial for us to do material science. So I think the key to accelerating materials discovery is a combination of AI and automation, so that a lot of the tedious processes that we do and a lot of the experimentation is accelerated. And also we choose smarter experiments to do after we did the past batch of experiments.
So do you think scientists should be cautious when it comes to AI or fully embrace it?
Look, I mean, there's also some caution in the sense that you don't want to have an AI control your synthesizer and the synthesizer make poison without you building the appropriate guardrails. So in terms of care, you have to care about the guardrails. Some people are experimenting a lot with large language models and chemistry materials. They have to think about what will be the consequences of these models instructing the robot to make something that is not so, for example, healthy or safe. So, but if you build the safety guardrails and you are responsible, then you should fully embrace it, because it's going to help us accelerate how we conduct science.
And we're talking about acceleration. It seems like quantum computing is just on the horizon. Is this going to be a game changer in scientific research?
Yes. I have to say yes, yes, yes. I'm a big believer in that. That's why this is the longest lasting research line in my research group. I started it when I was a postdoc and then started as a professor at Harvard in 2006. Since then, I've been working on quantum computing for materials. It's almost going to be 20 years. Quantum computing promises to be exponentially faster than classical computing at simulating materials and molecules. So once you have a quantum computer large enough, you will have exact simulation of molecules and materials. Game changer.
So setting the future aside, what computational ideas and methods can scientists do to help their ideas right now, today?
So this is the reason why my lab has always like 3 or 4 things going on. Right? I always think about what's 20 years from now, what's 10 years from now, and what's now. The things that we do right now is enabling these automated systems to do chemistry and material science in a very smart way. So I'm lucky enough to be leading a very large organization called the Acceleration Consortium at the University of Toronto that is helping us build these self-driving laboratories at scale. So to accelerate material science and chemistry in a variety of applications.
Right. Fascinating. Thank you so much, Alain, for taking the time and talking with us.
Thank you very much.
So that's all for today's show. Next time, we'll be chatting to geophysicists about all tech advancements in their field and how this can help battle climate change.
Until then, goodbye.
Bye.